FG people, hello and welcome to episode 186 of Blockchain Insider. I'm Mauricio Magaldi, Global Strategy Director for Crypto at 11FS, and I'm joined by my co-host, the amazing Kai Sheffield, Head of Crypto at Visa. What's up, Kai? How are you doing? Anything exciting you've been working lately?
I mean, this space just continues to speed up, and so there's so much going on. I can't believe it's been weeks since our last show. It's hard to keep track of time, but we got some amazing guests to help us unpack it.
Let's dive in. So it's awesome to have all of you with us. So today's show is a very exciting news show. And our main stories are the U.S. Congress is to introduce a new draft bill for stablecoins. Ethereum's Shanghai update is complete. So it's a new era for the staking withdrawals. We're going to go deep into that. And the European Parliament approved crypto licensing funds transfer rules under the MiCA regulation. To dig into all of this, we're joined by some fantastic guests. So first up, making a welcome return, is Rianne Lewis, developer, author, and cryptocurrency consultant. Rianne, how are you doing? Welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be back on.
Lovely to have you. Making a debut on the show, we welcome Robert Mullins, token design associate at Outlier Ventures. Welcome, Robert. How are you doing today?
I'm going well, thank you. And thank you for having me.
Awesome. We have another debut. Welcome, Lindsay Argalus, COO at TaxBit. Welcome to the show. And how are you doing today, Lindsay?
Doing well, thanks. Great to be here.
Awesome. So before we dive in, just as a reminder to our listeners, the views or opinions of our panel are their own and don't necessarily reflect those of the companies that they are representing. And as always, nothing we say should be taken as tax, financial, or legal advice. So go do your own research. Let's kick this thing off. So the U.S. Congress is to introduce a new draft bill for stablecoins. This draft bill provides a framework for stablecoins in the United States and was published in the House of Representatives Document Repository. The draft puts the Federal Reserve in charge of non-bank stablecoin issuers, such as crypto firms Tether and Circle, respectively, issuers of Tether USDT and the USD Coin or USDC. According to that document, insured depository institutions seeking to issue stablecoins would fall under the appropriate federal banking agency supervision, while non-bank institutions would be subject to Federal Reserve oversight. Failure to register could result in up to 5 years in prison and a fine of $1 million. Issuers out of the United States would have to seek registration to the business in the country. So, really interesting movement. I mean, we've seen a lot of activity on the stablecoin world, and there's a number of factors that make this bill, one, very unique, but also very important in terms of how the market is progressing in creating an environment where stablecoins are, with, you know, for the lack of a better word, stable, but also give clarity to people who are both issuing and consuming or using those digital assets on a day-to-day basis. So that's a lot to unpack. Let me start with you, Lindsay. What was your first reaction when you saw this in the news, and what do you think that this is indicating to the rest of the world?
Yeah, thank you, Mauricio. So I think it's helpful to start with kind of what are they solving for, right? And this is really around how do we better protect consumers, right? So that people will regain confidence in trying to use these assets. And so it's really around how do we decrease the risk of the issuer's ability to meet the redemption requirements, right? By meeting this reserve requirement with cash and cash equivalent. And so I think overall, this is a good move, right? To give clarity to what is required for issuers, to give confidence for people to actually engage with stablecoins. And I think it's overall, it's a good path forward, right? To, again, rebuild that confidence and trust that I think the industry greatly needs.
So that's a good point. And Jeremy Allaire, Circle's CEO, tweeted on a thread that there's, and I quote, "There's clearly the need for deep bipartisan support for laws that ensure that digital dollars on the internet are safely issued, backed, and operated." Rianne, you know, Jeremy and Circles are obviously interested in this to becoming something that is useful to them as well, and not, you know, hindering their business and how they treat stablecoins. Do you agree with this? I mean, is this something that is in line with the bill or needs a little bit more alignment from the market and the legislators? What's your take on that?
I think there are so many gray areas with it. I mean, I think we can all say that it's great, as Lindsay just said, everyone's seeking clarity, right? And I know we're going to be talking about the European situation later on, and it's been interesting how much crypto-friendly jurisdictions have been willing to compromise in order to get that clarity. So we all agree that clarity is a good thing, consumer protection is a good thing. But to my mind, the main flaws with this are it's very much framed in terms of an understanding of legacy finance, where you trust big issuers. They seem relatively unclear about what to do with the whole area of stable coins that are collateralized with non-dollars, non-treasuries, and so on. So they've kind of grandfathered in DAI, so to speak, and they've sort of pushed that reckoning a bit further down the line. My take on it is that it's quite likely to stifle innovation while bringing, in a way, maybe false security, because we've seen how, you know, even the best regulated banks collapse. And the whole point of having decentralized technologies is that there's obviously, you do your own research and there have to be some protections, but at the end of the day, you're not trusting centralized entities. And this, in a way, is just pushing the trust right back to the regulators. I'm a little nervous about that from that point of view. Also, it completely outlaws, I think, for a period of 2 years, correct me if I'm wrong, the development of algorithmic stablecoins. Well, yes, we've all seen bad things happening with algorithmic stablecoins, but that's not to say they will never work. They're a really interesting idea. So they've deferred decision-making around that. To me, it looks like a bit of a missed opportunity, but I guess let's see what happens with it overall.
Yeah, I like that you're pointing that two-year ban on what they call these stable coins that are not backed by tangible assets. They don't clearly state that. And they also announced that there's a study group on endogenously collateralized stable coins, which is crypto self-referencing stable coins. Robert, this kind of falls into your realm of expertise, I would assume, as a token designer. So in my mind, monetary policies are also algorithmic, but they're very slow algorithms because it's the real world. So they move much, much slower than the digital nature of crypto. Is this the time we need to actually figure out algorithmic stable coins in a way that is safe for everyone to use? What else do we need in that space?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And there is a lot of promise to algorithmic stablecoins. Obviously, over-collateralized stablecoins have limitations with capital efficiency and relying a lot of capital to be locked up more than what they produce. So we can't have stablecoins issued over-collateralized by ETH, for example, because it's just not very efficient and we can't run a banking infrastructure off that. And we come from the traditional banking system, which is fractionalized reserve. And now if we move towards the algorithmic style, we can have one-to-one capital creation, so value creation backed one-to-one. But I think, as we've seen, there haven't been any successful experiments, and I would call them experiments in this domain. I believe that we will eventually find something, but the market is very good at stressing these experiments and seeing if they will survive. So I think UST and Luna was a very good example of something that got very, very big and almost over the hump, I think, of being able to survive some sort of large stress test, but it didn't quite make it. So hopefully we can have some time in the future where one of these projects or experiments manage to build enough trust and enough resilience to handle the stress that will be put on them. And we see it with the banking in the traditional financial system. It doesn't matter whether it's a algorithmic stablecoin or a traditional bank, there will be stress that's put upon that by market participants and market forces. And I think just like the illiquidity and the immaturity of the market makes it hard for them to survive at this time.
And Kai, I mean, we've tapped into this a few times here in the show, and we say that more regulation is not necessarily better regulation. What's your opinion on how this thing can be really good for the environment?
So I think first, it seems pretty clear that there's a lot of global demand for stablecoins, that they have some, you know, real product market fit, that people want to use them. I think that there is a fair amount of confusion around the term stablecoin, given that anyone can call anything a stablecoin, and the underlying designs and mechanics of the products can be very different. And so I don't think it's good to have, you know, confusion, you know, in the market of, you know, marketing something as a stablecoin without people going under the hood and understanding, you know, what that term actually means. I think there have been some interesting dynamics that, you know, you could observe if you watch the hearing that happened, you know, last week. My understanding of it is that you know, there was this bill, you know, the McHenry-Waters, you know, bill, as it had been proposed, I believe, last year. And so there have been different versions of stablecoin bills, bipartisan, that have been, you know, floating around. And, you know, it seemed as if, you know, McHenry really was the driving, you know, force to kind of propose and bring this back up. But the reaction from Waters and the Democratic side was basically like, this wasn't really done in a bipartisan way in this version, and that many of the Democrats are saying, "What? So much has happened in crypto, and you know, you've had these collapses, you've had these issues. Like, maybe we need to go back to the drawing board, and we can't just continue, you know, where we were." And so it seems like there's still a fair amount of a gap, you know, between, you know, what McHenry initially, you know, has wanted to do, and where Waters and the Democrats sit, and it'll be interesting to see how that closes, and to just see different perspectives. I think there's some big questions around state versus federal. You know, most stablecoins today are regulated, you know, by states, whether it's New York and NYDFS or, you know, state level money transmission laws. And, you know, the question around, okay, well, if banks issued stablecoins, you know, that'd be federally regulated. You know, what's the role of the Fed? If you watch the testimony, I thought the most interesting one was Richie Torres. And having, you know, the superintendent of NYDFS there, it was an example of a Democrat who's very focused on the importance of having this duality of state-based approaches to stablecoins with federal approaches to stablecoins. So I thought overall it was a very productive discussion, and you're able to, I thought everyone who testified, you know, added value and contributions to the topic, and I'm glad that this is increasingly top of mind. But it feels like there's still a ways to go before there's alignment around what the rules should be, even if the recognition is that there need to be more rules around it.
Yeah, just maybe building off of that, going back to a point that Rian made, I think, you know, we're going to continue to see this healthy tension between the desire and need to create safety, clarity, protections, while at the same time promoting innovation, right? And that's going to be the tension. And we're going to see countries around the world strike very different balances along the spectrum, right? So if we think about, you know, the unlocking the merits or the benefits of decentralized technology, that's going a little bit counter to right now what we see in the stablecoin bill, right? Which is this trend towards increased centralized control framework, right? And governance structure that needs to be put in place on the issuer side. And so it is taking absolutely a page out of the playbook for traditional financial institutions. I think we want to take lessons learned from the way that traditional financial institutions have been regulated, but at the same time, take lessons learned for what has and has not worked, right? And have something that is fit for purpose. Again, trying to unlock the benefits of decentralized technology. So I think, you know, again, we're seeing lots of governments try different things. And this is just kind of, again, one iteration of that.
Yeah. And it's as per everything that the US touches, this is probably going to point the path forward across the world in other jurisdictions. So this is not the last time we're going to talk about this. But I want to pass it on to you, Kai, so we can explore a little bit on the Shanghai Capella upgrade on Ethereum.
Yeah. So for the next story, you know, Ethereum's Shanghai upgrade is complete, starting new era of staking withdrawals. So Ethereum's Shanghai hard fork, also referred to as Capella, has been finalized, enabling people who have staked their ETH to secure and validate transactions on the blockchain to be able to withdraw that staked ETH. And so I guess the way that I've thought about this is that, you know, we have the merge, which was a huge technological, you know, achievement, moving from proof of work to proof of stake, you know, back last September. And you know, they were able to effectively transition, you know, the consensus mechanism. But by design, you know, the people who had been staking, you know, ETH in order to secure the proof of stake blockchain were not able to withdraw. They wanted to make sure that the blockchain could operate. And you know, people didn't, you know, withdraw all at once. They wanted to make sure they could run. Now this is kind of the final leg of being able to withdraw the ETH that you have staked. And so maybe starting with you, Robert, like what does this mean? Why should people care? Like I saw some people were celebrating, other people were like, oh, like doom and gloom. Like what do you think the implications of this were, and like why should anyone care about this upgrade?
Yeah, very good question. And my Twitter feed was very mixed upon the Shanghai upgrade. There was a lot of different opinions, but I think it is very important. So it started a long time before really the merge and move to proof of stake, where the Beacon Chain stakers were actually staking since 2020 or late 2020. So these people have had their ETH locked. I think ETH was around $700 at that time, and they've been staked with no liquidity on those tokens. So for those people, you would assume they're like the diehard ETH supporters. They were willing to go an unknown amount of time without being able to withdraw their ETH. So that finally gives these participants some liquidity and be able to unstake their rewards as well as their principal. So I think that's a big thing. We did see a lot of different takes on whether it would be mass unlocking and selling and a lot of sell pressure, or if it wouldn't be as bad. But it turned out that it wasn't nearly as bad as what people imagined. And actually, I had a look earlier prior to this. And I think it's actually net positive. About 18 million ETH has been staked. So yeah, it looks good so far for the health of the network.
And then Rianne, curious your perspective on this. If you put this like in the context of crypto's evolution, can you help unpack like what did it mean for Ethereum to move from proof of work to proof of stake and to have successfully accomplished this? Like how big of a feat is that, and what influence does this have on the entire, you know, industry?
Okay, well, there's a few things to unpack here. First of all, I think we should take a minute to just consider the magnitude of what this open source development has actually achieved. Because if you're somebody who's working, for example, in enterprise software, to do a live release on this scale requires so much coordination, so much effort, and so on. And to do this with a team of essentially volunteers all working across the world to achieve, to agree on something and release it, and then have enough of the validators reaching consensus that they actually proceed with that fork. It's like a massive achievement. So that in itself is a real piece of good news for Ethereum, I think, considering its rather checkered history of forks and getting agreement in the past, way back. It's important because it sets the scene to make Ethereum more scalable in future. And that is desperately needed, because in the whole lifetime of Ethereum, in times of peak demand, we've seen very high congestion on the network, very high gas fees. So it's not just the move from proof of work to proof of stake, it's the whole piece around scaling the network, both the network itself and the layer twos and so on. And Vitalik Buterin's been very clear that this is just one step in a very, very ambitious roadmap that is going to take years. But I don't know if I can go the whole episode without mentioning proto-dank sharding. I'm not going to go into it in massive detail, but this is essentially a technology which is going to enable Ethereum to work at a much, much more efficient rate by breaking down the monolithic network into a multitude of small pieces that can work faster in conjunction with each other. All right, I'll stop with technical stuff now, but it's important to see Chapella, Shanghai, call it what you will, in the context of it being a piece of a whole roadmap, which we hope will move Ethereum towards a much, much more scalable and successful future. So while I was obviously quite happy to see that people were, you know, not selling the news, as it were, and the price actually had a little bounce straight afterwards. The price is not the most important thing here. And I know that we all say, you know, the price is the least interesting thing about whatever. But in this case, it's what it means for the technology rather than the market, I think, that is the big takeaway from this.
Now we're going to have to bring you back on for a deep dive on proto-dank sharding. Like, there's so many, like, interesting, complex topics in the Ethereum ecosystem. But, Lindsay, what does this mean for enterprise staking? You know, if you're a business and you were thinking about staking ETH and you wanted to generate yield or rewards, you know, on that ETH, you know, would you have done that before you could withdraw, like with some, maybe in the future you withdraw, or now does it become viable? And then, you know, with tax, but like, how should enterprises think about tax and regulatory? And like, what are you seeing in terms of the general appetite for enterprises to participate in validating transactions on public blockchains right now?
Yeah, no, we definitely see increased interest. And I think to your point, the fact that now there's some liquidity and ability to unlock, that certainly kind of opens the aperture for more enterprises to participate in this. I think also interesting in this is, you know, again, fully agree with what Robert and Rian said that about the technology significance of this milestone. But also it's interesting that it really is paving the way for yield curves and kind of developing a notion of expected rate of return on this kind of activity, which is much more akin to what we see in the traditional financial market. So I think that has a lot of significance, again, of driving broader enterprise adoption and just kind of involvement in this space. Interesting, another point from a tax perspective, you know, unlocking staked ETH alone itself is not a taxable event. However, you do have a huge tax issue now when we take into account the yield earned on the staked unit since the inception on the Beacon chain. And so before the ability to unlock, a user didn't have what's known as this dominion and control over it, right? So it was not considered taxable income. Now that a company or a user can actually go ahead and unlock the staked ETH, right, one could argue that now there is some control over that ability. And so that could be construed as taxable income. So the IRS has not issued any guidance on this yet. But when we look at the properties now of the fact that it is unlocked, we think there could be some interesting tax implications as well. So all unfolding continues to evolve, but we do see a lot of increased enterprise interest in the ability to stake and unlock.
I'm not surprised we haven't gotten detailed guidance on staking yet, although I know people have been asking for many years, and I think there are plenty of questions to please consult a tax professional for anyone there. Mauricio, do you have your ETH node up and running yet? Like, how are you thinking about staking from a consumer perspective? Is this going to be a mainstream consumer product? Is everyone going to do it through exchanges? Are they going to do it at home? What are these like liquid staking derivatives, you know, LSDs? Like, you know, what do you think about this space?
I really like that this gives the opportunity for a regular person to participate in securing transactions and renting their computer for that, for the network. I've been, you know, dabbing into the concept of home staking for a while. There are hardware companies and application companies that are offering that, but it's still the clunky, you know, hobbyist UX, I'd say. In my mind, every smart fridge in the world should be, you know, a validator of proof of stake blockchains, because now you don't have to have that super heavy computing rig, you know, eating up a ton of energy to compete to, you know, for the right to write the next block. So it creates this more of a balanced environment where every computer in the world could be, you know, with obvious exceptions, but could be playing a part in securing how we do business on the internet. And that is a beautiful thing, right? It's a beautiful design. And, you know, if we can fix that UX and if we can get like this, instead of plug and play, we have a plug and stake kind of, you know, devices, and you have like stable internet in, you know, some portion of the world, and we can start to actually, maybe we get to this ultimate decentralization that we keep talking about. And if that's the role of proof of stake networks in the internet economy, well, we should be striving for that. So I think there's a huge opportunity for consumers in that space. And if we can, as an industry, make that onboarding easier and easier to the point where, again, smart fridges are validating nodes for proof of stake networks, then we're going to have the real internet economy playing a role everywhere. And all of us could, you know, to that end, benefit from participating. So yeah, I'm super positive, and I would love to see, you know, some of these existing hardware wallet companies come up with something that is really enticing and make, you know, a little bit of competition to Dappnode, which is probably the one firm that I know of that is doing this right now. So yeah, it would be interesting to see the competition in that consumer space for sure.
Can I jump in? Sorry. It just reminded me because I was reading some stuff that Vitalik Buterin wrote the other day, and he didn't talk about fridges, admittedly, but he did say, I personally still want mobile phone staking to be possible on Ethereum. So if you think about the number of people who have access to the internet but who do not use computers, that is a huge chunk of the world. So speaking to what Mauricio just said, this idea of moving beyond like big rigs to a future where devices are, where you can stake on any device, is massive.
Maybe just to add there as well. So light nodes, or the concept of light nodes, is definitely on Ethereum scaling roadmap. And I think the next iteration of tech that's being built around this, like DVT or decentralized validator technology, which allows people or validators to share their keys amongst multiple people. So instead of one person running one validator, you can now run one validator between a group of friends. And that then reduces the limitation on internet uptime or slashing if your node is offline. So I think all of these things will enable scaling to be done on more and more devices, really. And basically, you could run a family household could run a light node on their phones. And if they're out of signal for any time, then it doesn't matter. They won't have any slashing or penalties for not being online.
I've heard of hot tubs mining Bitcoin, the idea of fridges validating Ethereum, and then families, devices, you know, validating transactions. There are so many cool things happening in just the underlying infrastructure for securing public blockchain networks. And I feel like if nothing else, as a listener, like just, you know, get into the weeds on the innovation, you know, happening here. So Mauricio, do you want to move on to the next story?
Yeah, we're just going to take a quick pause here while we hear from our sponsors, and we'll be back shortly. Don't go anywhere. This episode is brought to you by Visa, one of the world's leaders in digital payments. Crypto has opened up a new world of possibilities, and Visa's helping everyone take part. Consumers can now enjoy the freedom and flexibility of using their Visa crypto link cards for everyday purchases at millions of Visa-accepting merchant locations around the world. Join us in this new money movement. Learn more at visa.com/crypto. Welcome back. For the second half of the show, we're going to start off with the European Parliament approval of the MiCA regulation, which involves crypto licensing and funds transfer rules. The lawmakers in the European Parliament on Thursday voted 517-38 in favor of this new crypto licensing regime. We call it MiCA or MiCA, Markets in Crypto Assets, with 18 abstentions, making it the first major jurisdiction in the world to introduce a comprehensive crypto law. The European Parliament also voted 529-29 in favor of a separate law known as the Transfer of Funds Regulation, which requires crypto operators to identify the customers in a bid to halt money laundering. The vote follows a debate in which lawmakers largely supported plans to make crypto wallet providers and exchanges seek a license to operate across the block and require issuers of stablecoins tied to the value of other assets to maintain sufficient reserves. So there is this race on the G7 countries, or maybe the G20, of being the first, of moving towards being the first to regulate crypto. And obviously, it would be very beneficial to have some of the largest countries or the largest economic blocks to actually come up and say something for real that would give the industry clarity. It's a first. It seems it's not going to be the last version of MiCA that we're going to see. So I'm going to go with you, Lindsay. What is your first reaction to this? And am I right in saying that this is going to be iterated more and more? Because again, the market moves faster than regulation ever could.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, I would say this is indeed a monumental step forward, right? It is by no means perfect, but it has put a stake in the ground. And I think they've been also very public that they acknowledge the market continues to evolve very rapidly, and this will need to continue to adapt as well, based on the new use cases, based on new entrants and players, based on learnings, right, of what's working, what's not. I do think, again, this was in general, well received by the industry. We see that just the different approaches, right, of the European regulatory framework, the approach that the US is taking, right, a lot of companies voting with their feet, right, relocating their headquarters to Europe because they like the clarity there, even if it isn't, 100%. So I think it's going to go a long way. I think it sets an example. I think it will light a fire under the US as well. But again, it's not perfect, but I do think it's a step certainly in the right direction. It sets the tone for other markets around the world and is going to aim to promote innovation and attract the kind of investment within a safe environment, right, that the government feels like they have sufficient visibility, sufficient controls to keep the safety and soundness of the financial system. They'd rather have it be done in their backyard under their supervision, right, rather than it take place elsewhere.
Not to stir any controversy, but this is a very different stance than we're seeing in the US. It's more akin to what we've seen in the UK in terms of trying to balance, as you said, Lindsay. So I'm going to go with you, Robert. Does it mean that we're going to see more VC money pouring in Europe and maybe the UK rather than, dominating US as in the recent years? And does it mean that also talent gets attracted to jurisdictions with that level of clarity, which also means that we're going to see more apps coming out and more business models being innovative in Europe? What's your take on that? What do you expect to see? I mean, you're at OV, which is, a big in this space. What is it that you guys are seeing there?
Yeah. So we are seeing teams, especially US founders relocating. That is something that we have seen a trend of. And we are also seeing Europe becoming a bit of a hub for, especially DeFi is something that we've seen, but they seem to like a little bit more clarity. And as a working with tokens, anything advising on tokens, we like to know as well, basically, if you're not in the US, it gives some sort of clarity about what is possible and what's not possible, rather than just a blanket no on everything, which is what we generally assume. So I think VC money will be attracted, and Europe is still a good jurisdiction. There's good laws, there's good precedents set there. So I don't think VCs see a Europe business and think this is too risky, but we are seeing a lot of good builders starting to move either physically or their headquarters as well to Europe to try and make the most of what they're building rather than being constrained by the regulations in the US.
Nice. And in terms of this kind of race to be the crypto hub of the world that we're seeing in the headlines, Rianne, who's next in line? I mean, is there a big competition? We've seen a number of countries announcing some form of upcoming framework that would be able to do that. Is this for real? Is this a movement that is bound to, show some competition to Europe and maybe the UK?
Yeah, it's really interesting at the moment. As you say, it's a real competition. And we're obviously seeing some countries in the Middle East, like Dubai, particularly Saudi, really going out there to establish principles and attract business. But in terms of Europe, it's quite easy to overlook the great job they've done. Obviously, MiCA, call it what you will, is not perfect. And there are some decisions that they have deferred until further down the line. Obviously, proof of work, people are going to be a little bit concerned about the possibilities of potential restrictions. Maybe it also lacked some clarity around NFTs and DeFi. But the interesting thing was, about 4 months ago, I got invited to moderate a session at Europe House where European regulators were actually on panels discussing this together with some companies who were active in the EU to talk about how everyone saw it. And what really struck me is you were just talking about competition between countries to attract people. Previously, it had been a situation where the individual European countries were very much competing with each other to attract business. So you had countries like Lithuania, Estonia, particularly France, who had raced ahead with not exactly permissive regimes, but offering a lot of clarity and maybe a little bit more freedom in terms of innovation. So I went into this event expecting to hear, you know, rumblings of discontent about people being kind of railroaded into a sort of common EU approach. But actually, there was none of that. It really seemed that the amount of time that it took everybody to reach agreement was spent reaching genuine consensus that everybody seemed very happy with. And you could tell talking to people, you know, after the event and so on, that this was genuine. It wasn't just put on for the panel. So I think it does put Europe as a whole in a very, very strong position because the individual countries are still out there wanting to be competitive, but they have all agreed, even when perhaps it hasn't benefited their country directly, to sign up to this overarching set of principles, which will be iterated on over time. And while we are seeing, obviously, different areas becoming competitive, it's a major achievement what the EU has done with this framework. It's not perfect, but I think they've really taken the lead on this.
Sorry, Maurizio, I just wanted to elaborate a little bit on the enterprise side or the company side and what we see. As Robert mentioned, right, we're seeing innovators, developers increasingly shift to Europe. We certainly see that with a lot of the crypto native enterprise companies that maybe originally started being headquartered here in the US and increasingly shifting to Europe. But in addition to that, if we think about the real lock where digital assets become more mainstream, it's getting a lot of these very large Web2 companies participating in digital assets. Same thing with the very large traditional financial institutions. And what we see as we engage with a lot of these companies here in the US is they have very compelling use cases. They're doing a lot of really interesting experimentation, very smart people working on these things. But they are not putting them out publicly because they are either, you know, large public companies that come under great scrutiny and or they have regulatory licenses and as a result, you know, are held to a very high bar. And the risks are just too great. And so in absence of clarity, right, you have a lot of great innovation that is happening behind closed doors that aren't seeing real market and customer activity yet. And so again, that can only go on for so long. And the longer that perpetuates, obviously, you have a growing gap or discrepancy, right, between Europe and the US and other markets.
Well, global companies are going to have to deal with regulatory arbitrage, right? And that's not good for anyone involved, because if you're a small company, you're going to have to, you know, pick up your stuff and move to somewhere where you're welcome. If you're a big company, where do you start? How do you actually move towards adopting digital assets as part of your core strategy? And, you know, not to disclose any client confidential information, but one of the questions we get from our clients at LFS is, where can I start first if I have to, right? And as major jurisdictions get more clarity, they will probably, as Robert was saying, attract some of that, not only from the entrepreneurial side, but more on the corporate side. Kai, you have a global role on your end, and I'm not going to ask you to disclose anything about the work you do on a day-to-day with Visa, but what's your individual perspective from your standpoint?
I think just in general, my reaction to this news first is like the tone sends a pretty clear signal that Europe views this technology and industry as legitimate. And like that matters more than anything. It's like, sure, there are rules that, you know, could be better, or like, you know, people don't agree with, but like it's kind of a binary decision that each country has to make of, is there any potential innovation being built in these open source public, you know, blockchain ecosystems that could benefit our country, whether it's in terms of products for our consumers or jobs, you know, for our citizens or not. And I feel like Europe has said, yes, that like there could be. And so like we're looking to provide some clarity and who knows, you know, what it's going to lead to, but, you know, very much, you know, wanting to explore the potential that these technologies could provide. I think there are other jurisdictions across the world who have, you know, been on the forefront in leaning in and saying, yes, like, you know, we want to work with you. And I think there are some jurisdictions that are still saying no. And I think in most countries, it's not, you know, every country itself, every regulator, every government, there are many diverse interests inside of the institutions. And so I think most countries are still trying to figure that out, where there are some people inside institutions saying there's a lot of promise here, others saying there's no promise here. This could never lead to anything other than negative externalities. And I think it's going to take time to resolve that. And some countries, I think, will be open to, you know, experimenting and you know, embracing the industry, and other countries won't. And so I think it's just going to take many, many years, you know, to play out. But there's no question that this is a global technology and it's a global industry. And so, you know, I think that if it does turn out to drive real innovations across payments and financial services and commerce and other elements, I think it's very clear that the countries that are earlier to recognizing and providing rules for it will benefit relatively to others. And that doesn't mean that you can't have late starts that, you know, can come in very quickly and have success. But I think it's going to be really interesting to see it play out. And, you know, it's not going to play out in 6 months or a year. It's going to play out in the next 5 years. So that's just my general view.
I love that you say that this is a validation, because the other day I read somewhere, I think it was on crypto Twitter, someone said, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. So I think that's, it's not everywhere and not evenly distributed, but I think coming from a major jurisdiction, that certainly means a lot. So that gives us a good wrapping point for us. And we're going to jump to the next segment, the last segment of the show, where I want to take a look at what specifically is making you guys excited about the industry. So I'm going to start with you, Rianne. What is the one thing that's happening in the industry that you're excited about?
Okay, I'm cheating because I'm taking something that's actually blockchain and crypto adjacent rather than fundamental. But to me, the beta launch of Blue Sky, the new social network, is fascinating because it heralds this move to protocols rather than platforms. And it's been really interesting that so many people outside the, you know, our little bubble have been so interested to find out more. I've seen a lot of people asking each other on Twitter what the protocol is, not just people, technologists or people within crypto or whatever. So I do think watch this space, the whole thing of decentralized social identities, decentralized social graphs and so on is a hugely interesting area.
Nice. Robert, what's the one thing that is exciting about the industry these days?
Yeah, I think leaning on from what Rian said, it's the mobile-facing application. So Solana just released their mobile phone that is designed around Web3 technology. So there's the dApp store next to the Google Play store or whatever the application store is on that phone. And we also saw Uniswap app get finally accepted into the Apple App Store as well, which I have downloaded it myself. It is not the most intuitive application. And I think there's a lot of constraints that Apple have implied or applied onto Uniswap, but I think it's a step in the right direction. Once you're in the App Store, maybe they can try and work around some of those rules. But I think hopefully this is how we onboard the next billion people, is not via clunky web applications where we have to change our RPC and all of these things. It's going to be on your phone, how everyone, everywhere you walk around is communicating. So I think the social applications and mobile phone applications is how we onboard everyone. And that's what's exciting me.
Nice. Lindsay, what's yours?
Yeah, through various conversations I've had in the last few weeks, and saw a good headline this week, and the topic of tokenization. So that is something that's obviously not going to happen overnight. This is a medium to long-term play, but ultimately the prospect of tokenizing a lot of these assets that have historically been very illiquid, right? The size of the private assets or the private markets, right, is roughly double that of the public markets. And so when we think about the ability for these financial institutions to tokenize that, I think it's just really an exciting and, you know, thing that makes great use of the technology, but also unlocks, I think, just a lot of innovation and a lot of potential, moving us more towards that tokenized economy. So really excited that big companies and financial institutions are leaning into this. It's going to take time, but I think it'll be a game changer.
I love that too. Kai, what's yours?
I guess lately, as you know, I've been nerding out with a bunch of AI tools and just experimenting with, you know, creating different types of videos and songs. And it's super fun. I highly recommend people use the tools. And it's got me interested in streaming micropayments again. Because like the payment experiences for many of these tools, I feel like I saw one that, you know, if you're training an OpenAI API, they charge you like 0.003 like per token based upon how much you're training. And so it's, I never really understood micropayments from a consumer facing, let me like pay per click or like pay to read an article. Like it just, that behavior for whatever reason hasn't emerged. But if you're running programs as a developer and you're training or you're tuning models and you're using an API, which actually like burns some real compute to be able to do it, I think having a pay per API call makes sense. And so I think it's one area where, like, you know, Lightning Network and like sats as a subset unit of account, like it's hard to say something costs 0.00003. It's much easier to say it's one sat. It's like one sat per API call and like 1,000 sats and like, go ahead and just run it. So I'm very interested in what payment innovations can emerge when a bunch of developers are using a bunch of AI APIs and to try and do some interesting things around pay per API call.
I like that. For me, it's similar, but not exactly on the AI blockchain interaction, because we have lost ownership of our data in the way the web runs today. And most of the data that's public and have been used to train these models and, you know, scrape for the internet has no assigned ownership. So you can actually attribute anything. I feel that with this new emergence of AGI and the independent agents and all of that stuff, we need to reclaim a little bit of that, because otherwise we're going to lose what intellectual property means for us as a society. And I think the intersection between AI in that space and blockchain, how blockchains can come into play in digital ownership, I think it's something that we need to, if we're not discussing this openly right now, we're already late. So I think this is one of the aspects of the new wave of innovation in AI excites me. It's how much more important digital ownership is going to become if this is to become more general use for all of us in society. So hopefully we're going to see more developments in that space as well. That wraps up this week's news show. So just as a quick reminder to let you know that the views of our panel are their own and not necessarily the opinions of the companies that they are representing. So thank you so much to all our guests. Where can people find more about you, Rian?
On Twitter, at Rianne underscore is.
Awesome. Robert?
On Twitter as well, at 0xlude.
Great. Lindsay?
Yeah, on LinkedIn and Lindsay at taxbit.com.
Great. Kai?
On Twitter at Kai Sheffield and visa.com/crypto.
And as for me, I'm 0x Mauricio on Twitter, Mauricio Magaldi on LinkedIn, and of course, 11fs.com. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, subscribe to our podcast so you never miss an episode. And if you really love it, please leave us a review. It helps us make it better and helps other people find the show. As always, if you want to join the conversation, find us on social media. Just search for 11FS or Blockchain Insider or email us at podcasts@11fs.com. This is all for today. Stay rare, stay weird. LFG.